Bert Sharp of the Golden Valley Electric Association remembers Greening for his contribution to Alaska's development.
During the late 40s, Senator Greening was a big advocate of rural electrification in Alaska. Prior to that time, there was no funds available for electrification in the rural areas or the immediate surroundings of the larger cities. With his help, funds were obtained. The birth of the REA co-ops did happen in the late 40s and early 50s, not only here in Fairbanks, but Chugach Electric in Anchorage and other towns all over the state of Alaska.
William Cashin remembers a visit by Greening as governor to the campus of the university.
The war was on, and the student body had been greatly reduced, and the faculty also. I was on the faculty at this time. And I remember that Ernest Greening visited the campus, and Dr. Bunnell invited him to address the assembly. And he did. Of course, he was just a grand speaker. I don't think that he has ever been surpassed as far as a public speaker, in my opinion. But he rather held the whole student body and the faculty that attended somewhat spellbound. And I remember that Herta Ward, the professor of business administration and the commercial teacher, she came taking with a notebook, and she was taking notes. And she'd been a court reporter, so she could follow the talk right through. And after the at the end of the program, she remarked that that was the finest talk that she had ever heard, and that she could take her shorthand notes and transcribe them, and you could publish it exactly as it was, just as it was spoken, which is a remarkable ability to be able to speak that perfectly, that whatever you said could be just put into print, and it would read just fine. But throughout those preceding years, and of course even afterwards, he was a strong supporter of the university, and always in his message to the legislature urged that the legislators appropriate some funds so that we could get out of the old wooden building structures that we were in and into something more permanent and worthy of our of our responsibility.
A fellow Democrat, Dick Gruhl, met Greening for the first time in 1949.
Ernest Greening was not the kind of political figure that remembers your name, and I met him probably about six or seven times after that. And he'd always come up to me in a very friendly, sincere manner and say, hello, I'm Ernest Greening, and I'd like to meet you, or something like that. He was always a very gracious person, but he was not the kind of typical politician that remembers first names and things like that. He had his mind on the really, you know, the really big concerns of the time. He was a very, very moral person. He'd say strong things like so-and-so was sold out to the canned salmon industry or something like that, but never once would he utter an expletive or say something that was even the least little bit off color.
Some of this strong language Greening used against, in his words, the lobbyists whose flag is the dollar sign and who are enemies of the democratic process. In 1947, Time magazine featured Greening in its cover story. According to Time, when Greening became governor, Alaska's economy was tied almost completely to a salmon industry owned in Seattle and to a gold industry owned in the East. Greening charged that Alaska was victimized by absentee government, was gutted by an absentee industry, served by seasonal labor. Greening asked Alaskans to set up a general territorial property tax, a corporate net income tax, a personal income tax on the salaries of migrant fish and cannery workers and other laborers who took their salaries to Seattle each autumn. Such strong words made enemies of the salmon and gold industries, as well as some Alaskans who still regarded Greening as a carpetbagger. Austin Lathrop charged that Greening didn't belong in Alaska. Lathrop said, in his words, "He has been pitting one element against another, screaming for development on one side of his mouth and proposing prohibitive taxes on the other." In 1949, Greening's enemies mobilized their forces. Many charged him with striving for personal power at the expense of the best interests of the state of Alaska, with the territory of Alaska at that time. Greening answered the charges of dictatorship and unscrupulous campaigning for his favorite legislative candidates, and the Senate Interior Committee and the Senate itself confirmed him for another term as governor of Alaska. In 1953, when Republican Dwight Eisenhower replaced Democrat Harry Truman as President of the United States, Republican Frank Heintzelman replaced Democrat Ernest Greening as governor of Alaska.
Meanwhile, of course, Alaska was paying all federal taxes, so we were subject to taxation without representation, which our colonial forefathers declared to be tyranny in the 18th century, and certainly was no less so in the 20th. Well, in 1945, it seemed to me the time had come, we ought to do something about it. So I proposed to the legislature that they put a referendum on the ballot in the next election to determine whether the people of Alaska really wanted statehood. It would seem impossible to think that they didn't want statehood, but the absentee interests largely controlled the territory at that time. It was quite apparent to anyone serving in the legislature, and they didn't want statehood. They merely wanted to take everything they could out as rapidly as possible and not be burdened with the additional costs which statehood would clearly bring about. So it was necessary to get a reading, and this was placed on the ballot for the 1946 election, which would take place the following October. In April of 1945, after the legislature had adjourned, President Roosevelt died and was succeeded by President Truman. And President Truman had sent out word that he would like the governors to call upon him, and I took advantage of this invitation to call upon him when he was visiting his friend Governor Mon Morgan on the West Coast at his home in Olympia. And I went to see him, and I told him about the action of the legislature and asked him whether he could see his way clear in his first State of the Union message, which would take place the following January, to give Alaska a plug. And he said he would, and he did. In his message in January of 1946, he urged the Congress to enact statehood for Hawaii, which had already been holding hearings on it for some time, and that if the people of Alaska, at the coming election the following October, voted for statehood, that they too should have a statehood bill. And that was the beginning of the campaign of the present day. And in that same legislature, a resolution sponsored by Stanley McCutcheon of Anchorage and Fred Hanford of Wrangell, supporting statehood, passed the legislature. And now that we had a mandate, we could start working on it. And as far as my own part was concerned, I frequently had to go to Washington in those days, testify before committees on Alaska's needs, to assist our excellent voters delegate, Bob Bartlett, and I would take every opportunity on those trips to speak to as many groups as would listen to me. I talked to service clubs, to teachers' conventions, to women's clubs, to church groups, to Legion and Veterans of Foreign Wars posts. And I would tell them about the great beauties of Alaska, its charm, its unspoiled wilderness, the friendliness of its people, but I would also point out how badly we needed a better deal from the federal government, which could be only achieved by statehood. And I must have talked in that next decade to at least 250 audiences all over the country, and I always found them very responsive. And invariably, there would be a question period, and in that question period, someone would ask, what may we do to help you get statehood? And of course, the answer was, if those here are sympathetic with our cause, if they want to help us, they can do it by writing just three letters, one to each of your two senators and one to your congressman, because statehood will come when and if a statehood bill is enacted in a single session of Congress. It was a very interesting experience because I discovered what I was able to call the vast political illiteracy of the American people. I would find audience after audience who after this little conversation between the speaker and the audience took place, and I would ask him, by the way, who is your congressman? And I found many audiences that hadn't the slightest idea who he was. And if they didn't know what his name was, of course, how much further they were removed from knowing whether he was a good congressman, whether he carried out their wishes, or how he represented the district from which he was elected. But in any event, hearings began to be held in the House in 1947, and in the meanwhile, a statehood association was organized here in Anchorage, largely under the leadership of Bob and Evangeline Atwood, which started writing letters to people in the states urging them to support any statehood bills. It got out literature, a very impressive pamphlet entitled 83 Years of Neglect, written by Evangeline Atwood, which told the story in some detail, some of which I've told you, of how we were the victims of discrimination. And the first hearing was held in the Senate in 1950. And this went on, and these reports were invariably favorable. Committees came up, and almost without exception, the committee reports would be that statehood was proper and should be had. But for some reason or other, we were never able to get both the House and the Senate to vote for statehood in the same Congress. And so we had to start all over again. And in the meanwhile, people becoming impatient, in 1953, in the legislature, and this was a legislature that was elected after the Eisenhower landslide, and it was preponderantly Republican, in the House there were four members who were Democrats, and they sponsored a bill to have a constitutional convention which would draft a constitution for the state we hoped to come into being. This had these four Democrats as sponsors, and it was referred to a committee on statehood where it was promptly interred and buried without trace for the rest of that session. But in the next session, where the situation was reversed, and there was a preponderantly Democratic legislature, this bill passed, and $300,000 were appropriated to hold this constitutional convention, which, as you know, was held on the campus of the University of Alaska beginning in November of 1955, where these 55 delegates, who were elected by a very intelligent and far-sighted procedure, so that the people of Alaska felt they had the widest kind of representation. There were a certain number of delegates who were elected at large, there were some who were elected in their judicial districts, and some locally, so that we had the broadest kind of representation. And these 55 delegates, and Muktuk Marston was one of them, drafted a constitution which political scientists declared to be at least as good as, if not better than, any existing charter. But there was one thing that took place there which really brought about statehood. And that, I think, can be used to illustrate the potency of an idea. There was a man, a Louisianan, who had been stationed in Honolulu in the Navy during the war. His name was George H. Leilightner, and he developed a great sympathy for the cause of Hawaiian statehood, and he had dug up a most interesting precedent out of American history. And that precedent was that in 1796, the people living west of the Carolinas and south of the state of Kentucky, envious because Kentucky had been admitted to the Union in 1792, and disturbed because the first three Congresses had not given them statehood, and for a time they called themselves the state of Franklin, elected two senators, which was easy to do in those days because at that time senators were elected by the legislature and not by the people, and sent them to the capital, which was Philadelphia, to work for statehood. And in 4 months they came back with statehood, and Tennessee then became the 16th state. Leilightner had proposed this to the delegate from Joe Farrington, and to his predecessor, Sam King. And they listened but said it was wholly unnecessary, that they expected to get statehood without it, that their good friend Joe Martin, who was the Speaker of the House in the 80th Congress, which was Republican Congress, would surely put this through. But nothing happened. It stayed. The Constitution, which the Hawaiians drafted in 1950, merely was collecting dust in pigeonholes. And when Leilighten told me about this, I thought it was a splendid idea and suggested that he go up and address the Constitutional Convention and try to sell them this idea. And I talked to some members of the Constitutional Convention. He went up there and they accepted this idea. And so when the Constitution was put to a vote in April of 1956 to determine whether the people of Alaska would accept or not accept the Constitution drafted by the Constitutional Convention, this proposition of electing three, as we call them, Alaska-Tennessee Plan senators and two senators and a representative and send them to Washington was adopted by the people. And as a result, three of us, Bill Egan and Ralph Rivers and I, were elected, and we went to Washington to lobby for statehood. We were not seated. It might be said that this idea, which Tennessee launched in 1796, was then followed by seven other states. It was followed by Michigan in 1835, by Iowa in 1846, by California in 1850, by Minnesota in 58, by Oregon in 59, and by Kansas in 61. But people had forgotten about it. But Leilighten, having studied this aspect of American history and having come up with this idea, gave us this idea which really brought us statehood. Because although we were not given any particular status, we were not seated as the earlier Tennessee Plan senators and their successors had been in the Congress. We were considered lobbyists, but merely with a little more prestige and a little more justification. And for the next 2 years, we went around buttonholing members of the Senate and the House and trying to persuade them the statehood was desirable. Well, we encountered some pretty good obstacles. The two main obstacles were our small population and that $64 word, non-contiguity. I can still hear the declamations of some of our Southern friends, we'll never vote to be in a state that doesn't touch the other 48 states. If we admit Alaska, we're going to be admitting New Zealand and Australia and India and Israel. No, never. And then the population was something of a problem. Of course, it was a problem. The census of 1950, under which we're working, gave us about 125,000 people. And I remember some very sympathetic friends in the Senate who would say, you know, we want to see you get statehood, but how can you justify giving this handful of people, two senators, when the great state of New York, with 15 million people, has only two senators? Well, we answered that argument by pointing out that if that had been the line of thinking in the early days, we still would only have 13 states, because the western states were very sparsely populated in proportion to the original 13, and it was only as they got statehood and population began to move west that they began to catch up. But we did encounter some that were completely obdurate. I remember calling on a distinguished Southern senator, and I'd more or less left him to the last because I knew he'd be very antagonistic. In fact, I'd seen him over in the House lobbying there against it because he was afraid that if the House passed it, the Senate would. And when I came in to see him, I said, Senator, I've come to talk to you about Alaskan statehood. He said, how many white people you got? Well, I said, we've got about 200,000. He said, I didn't ask you that. I said, how many white people? And I said, well, we don't count people that way. We just have people. He said, the census says you have 125,000. I said, well, we've grown markedly since then. He said, all I know is a census of 125,000. Now, I've asked you, how many non-whites have you got? And I said, well, we have about 30,000-40,000 natives. Well, he said, that gets you down to 85,000. I said, well, don't you count them as people? No, they're savages. How many military have you got? Well, I said, about 30,000. He said, that gets you down to 55,000. How many dependents of military? Oh, I said, perhaps 10,000. He says, oh, every soldier's got a wife and two children. You're down to 25,000. How many government employees have you got? Well, I said, aren't they people? He said, they're transients, they're birds of passage. Well, by the time we got through with me, we had no population at all. Well, we did manage to overcome that. And in the meanwhile, we had mobilized a great many groups. And this state of association, which I mentioned earlier, had been of inestimable help. It had written letters to all kinds of people in the states, asking them to write their senators. The Gallup polls were increasingly favorable. The American people were way ahead of the Congress on this matter. And the press was extremely favorable. One of the fortunate aspects is that when I was running around talking to people, I would also call on the newspaper editors. And as a former newspaper editor, I had a sort of an entree there. And it was an interesting fact that on the eve of statehood, there was only one major city newspaper, a paper in Richmond, that was opposed to statehood. The press was almost uniformly favorable. And in many cases, they would be extremely helpful when we found some recalcitrant congressmen and senators. We would call up an editor whom we'd known back home, and he would find a way to communicate his surprise that his representative could be so reactionary as to oppose this great and glorious project statehood for Alaska. And then we had a number of very active groups for us. The Federation of Women's Clubs was really enlisted. And they would buzz around, some of the recalcitrant senators, like angry hornets. And the JCs and the Kiwanis Clubs and the Veterans of Foreign Wars were particularly active. And we would find that in certain states where senators were obdurate, and this was particularly true of the southern states, this is a little inside for the political science students, there would be some very important man who was very influential in the life of a senator. He might be the president of an oil company or of an electric utility, and that if he could be convinced, the senator would likewise be convinced. And so when we found that the senator was particularly obdurate, and we found who this man was who had great powers of persuasion over him, we would sic the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the Kiwanis Clubs and the Federation of Women's Clubs, and this man would be pleasantly surprised that this subject, to which he'd not given very much attention, was really of importance. And this conversation actually took place, as I learned later. This powerful man from one of these states would call up his friend the senator, and they would discuss various things. And finally he'd say, Bob, how do you stand on statehood for Alaska? Ha! Statehood for Alaska? Why, that's a cockeyed idea. I'm against it. Oh, I'm sorry to hear you say that. I was hoping you before. Are you for it? Why didn't you tell me? I'll take another look. And I promptly got a call from the senator and said, tell me this story all over again that you were telling me as to why Alaska should have statehood, which we did. And so we finally got it. And I would say that very few people, I think, would doubt that it's been beneficial. In the first place, in the abstract, it has applied to us that most basic of American principles, the principle of government by consent of the governed.
The battle for statehood won, Greening began the campaign to represent the state as one of its senators. The present and last territorial governor, Mike Stepovich, campaigned as the Republican candidate. In the primary, Stepovich gained 5,700 votes more than Greening. Greening, therefore, faced the general election as an underdog. As part of his platform, Greening pointed out that he had sponsored a bill in 1945 allowing 18-year-old Alaskans the right to vote. The Organic Act of 1912, however, had prevented the young Alaskans from exercising their voting rights without congressional approval, and Congress had not approved. Greening told the voters that with statehood, Alaska could enact such legislation. Underdog Greening walked up and down the main street of Anchorage with an outstretched hand. "My name is Greening," he would say. "I'm a candidate for the United States Senate, and I'd appreciate your vote." One man pulled his hand away suddenly from Greening's. "You're Greening? I'd sooner vote for the devil." Greening recalls being taken aback, but remembering advice given by experienced office campaigners never to lose his temper. So the candidate replied, "You know, he'd be a tough guy to beat. But if he decides not to run, do you suppose he could switch to me?" The potential voter stared back at Greening for a moment. Then he said, "Why, you son of a gun," that wasn't the exact expression he used, "I might vote for you yet." The Secretary of the Interior, Frederick Seaton, and the Vice President, Richard Nixon, came up to campaign for Stepovich. Idaho Senator Frank Church and Massachusetts Senator John Kennedy spoke for Greening. In Anchorage, a columnist for the Anchorage Times, Bob Ketterick, asked Kennedy if it would be better to have one Democrat, Bob Bartlett, regarded as unbeatable, and one Republican, namely Stepovich. Kennedy answered that there would be, in the next Senate, 34 Republicans and 62 Democrats. Kennedy argued that Alaska should not send a man who would serve on the least important committees. Instead, said Kennedy, "Alaska can send two senators and a representative already known and respected." Kennedy urged Alaskans to, in his words, re-elect the team that brought statehood. On Election Day 1958, over 4,300 votes that had gone to Stepovich in the primary went this time to Greening. On January 7, 1959, United States Senators number 97 and 98 arrived in Washington. Bob Bartlett and Ernest Greening flipped a coin to decide who would be the senior senator. Ernest Greening, 1 month shy of his 72nd birthday, became the junior senator. Next, the two senators drew lots to decide the length of their first terms. Bartlett drew the number 2 and a 2-year term. Greening drew the number 4 and a 4-year term. Then Vice President Richard Nixon administered the oath of office to Bartlett and Greening as senators from the state of Alaska. A dream had come true. You've been listening to part 1 of Alaska's Flag at Half-Mast, a commemoration of Ernest Greening. This is Jeff Kennedy. David Rod Chetnik has served as co-producer and audio engineer. The University of Alaska sent you this program.